Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Cindy Baldwin.
And you are listening to the midweek version of the Fiber Talk podcast that we do twice a week, except this week for needlework artists. Yeah. Okay, so no stitch hour tonight because we're doing the podcast this week. We will have a stitch hour next week, and I haven't confirmed the scheduling, but there is an excellent chance that Kim Young will join us. Her mother was a professional seamstress and made dolls, and Kim has kept them, and she said they're not creepy dolls. So
that's good.
Yeah, because you know how that can go. So anyway, she has volunteered to show us some of the creations from her mother.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so that would be really cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, creepy dolls. Here's a creepy doll thing. Marga, when she was growing up, there was this doll that was like, if you were 6-7 years old, a doll that was your size that you could, it would walk. If you would just hold its hand, it would walk, kind of.
Ew.
Yeah. And so that got kept. I think I'm sure it got trashed when Marga's mother died and they sold the house. You talk about creepy. Yeah, that was a horror movie waiting to be made, is what that was. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the last doll I've dealt with. It sticks in my mind. But anyway, Kim is at the other end of the spectrum. Positive, encouraging, enlightening dolls. So I hope it'll work out. We're going to try. See if we can get her to get it scheduled and get her to show up, because that would be really cool. You know, that stuff that your parents made, you know, that you hang on to is so cool.
Right.
So, yeah. Yeah, you got your mother's, you know, how many of your mother's, I don't know how many you kept, but, you know, that's special stuff.
Well, I have a lot of them. I still need to find someplace, some other home for most of them. But I will keep some of them for sure.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, we got one hanging in our living room. It's it's beautiful. Yeah. So hopefully next Wednesday, Kim will do that. Now, there will not be a show this Sunday of any kind. There are 700 plus shows already recorded, so you can go listen to one of those that you might have missed. But logistics for what I've got going this weekend just don't allow me to process and post a show. It's just not going to work. I've tried. Normally I'll move a small mountain to make sure that we have a show every Wednesday and every Sunday, but it's just not going to work this week. So there won't be any show other than the 700 that are already recorded and are available at wetalkfiber.com if you missed them.
Right.
Yeah. And not to mention the live shows on the YouTube channel, which is, I don't know, probably a couple hundred of those. So
there's plenty of content out there.
Yeah. You won't be lacking. A week from Sunday, though, holy smokes, will be the show that we recorded with the ladies from the Royal School of Needlework talking about what the Royal School did in preparation for the coronation. And that will be...
I'm really excited about that.
Oh, man. It's so cool. And and actually going up on the 5th and the 6th of May was when the coronation was, so almost a year to the day.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I've got to work on the video a little bit, but and I'm such a video expert. Jeez, I hate doing that. But it's just amazing. Well, I showed some of that last Wednesday on the show, some of the work that they did. It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. I watched, I mean, you know, the video of the coronation was, I don't know, 24 hours or something stupid like that. And I fast forwarded through a lot of it just because I wanted to see what I could see of the embroidery. And I didn't get to see a lot of it, but I saw, you know, some of the robes, and I think I saw the coronation screen, but of course I didn't know about it until afterwards, you know, when they could talk about what they did.
Yeah. 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 That was the trouble, because we did a show or two with them ahead of the coronation, but they couldn't talk about anything
right
other than they were involved. And and from what I picked up, that was a fairly fluid situation in terms of what they were going to be asked to do and what was not needed. And but yeah, making the anointing screen, and oh yeah, so cool, so cool.
Yeah, and I there is information I think on their website about it, but you know, I'm sure we'll get more information. I'm sure you got more when you were talking to them directly.
I hope so, or it was a miserable effort. yeah, it's just so amazing that they can just bring together graduates from everywhere,
right,
or you know, whatever level of a person, and have them all work on the same objects, and it all comes out the same.
Mm-hmm.
I know they're trained that way. You know, I know that's the deal. But still, they're humans, you know, and it's amazing to me. Yeah.
Well, and especially so many of them have gone off and done, you know, still embroidery, but wildly different from, you know, what they did when they were at the Royal School. And so to come back and pick up with that same level of expertise and competence and consistency is pretty impressive.
Now there's a show. You just gave me an idea for a show, because we've talked to several who are involved through the years.
Huh? Yeah. Oh.
What was the experience like coming back, especially those who went off and kind of, you know, all right, I learned from you guys, now I'm going to do it my way.
That would be interesting.
Yeah. Did you just fall right back in, or did you have to make a conscious effort?
Did you have to practice?
Yeah. Oh, that's a good idea. All right. I know. And I know a couple of people we can get, I think.
Yeah.
Ho, 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 ho. Okay. And you know what they're going to say? We can't talk about it. I got to try. Okay. I know a couple.
Oh, yeah. You have to try.
Yeah. Good idea. All right. All right. Coronation from the Stitcher's perspective, making a note. That would be cool.
Yeah, that would be cool.
All right. Going to give it a shot. Yeah, and I've got to do a show with Susan K. Williams, just a show with her and her career and her stitching and how she got to be the head of the Royal School.
Yeah.
She's amazing. She's absolutely amazing. The interview, you'll see it in the video, the history that she has in her head, and she had some notes there, but not the kind of notes that would equate to what she, you know, all the things she shared. And every time we talk to her, she just is just this fountain of knowledge. It's so fun. So, yeah.
Yeah, that would be a good show.
Yeah. All right. I'm sure I can line that up. So, all right. But, oh, yeah, good idea. Coronation from the Stitcher's perspective. Ha ha. All right. Future shows getting created on the fly. Here we go. Yep. All right.
Yeah, that's the easy part, though.
Yeah. Yeah. Coming up with the idea. That's easy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then you have to execute it. Yep.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. And we got one coming up with Isabella Rosner, who is a curator. We talked to her a couple, 3 weeks ago. So we're going to talk to her about her career.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Yeah. So that'll be interesting. And
then was she going to talk about what she's doing with digitizing the collection?
Yeah, well, we talked about that when the last show we did with her, but I want to explore that more. And then she has a book.
Yeah. Right, I saw that.
Yeah, but then she also has a PhD in some form of textile art. I got to find out about that, because, you know, from a parent perspective, yeah, I want to go get a PhD in textile arts. I'm not sure that's going to pay well, you know?
Yeah.
Tuition's kind of expensive. Do we really want to do this, Isabella? And, you know, yeah. But then here she is. So,
right.
Yeah, you got to learn about that. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, any of those kind of museum conservation type jobs are, you know, kind of iffy always, because those are the institutions that don't have a lot of money to pay a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah. Or pay them extremely well, or a lot of things, yeah. Yeah.
I think a lot of people do it on kind of a consulting type basis.
And have a side hustle of some kind that supplements.
Probably.
Yeah.
Right. Probably. Yeah.
Yep. So yeah, we've got that coming up. We're going to talk to her. That's going to be good. Because she does her own podcast. What is that called?
I don't know. I've been listening to So What, I think.
Is that what it is? Yeah.
S-E-W.
Yeah. I think that's the one.
I've been listening to it for quite a while.
Yeah. Yeah, I have them all. I've listened to all of them, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Interesting history, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
So, so she's coming up. But a week from Sunday is going to be the coronation from what the Royal School did. And, wow, very cool. I still, you know, one of the things I wanted to know about was procuring materials. And basically, it sounded like when I asked them about that, they pretty much had everything on hand or could get it through just normal ordering, which is impressive to me.
Right.
Because wouldn't you think if you're doing something for the coronation, the first thing you do is you sit down and you say, all right, we need to have massive amounts of all these things. Order them quick. But nope. So.
Well, they may have been preparing for it for some time, you know, because obviously they knew there was going to be a coronation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, even if they didn't know for sure what they were going to do and what the designs were going to be, they would have known that they would have needed a lot of gold metal.
Yeah.
Gold metals, for right. All of the gold work. So they may have tried. And the manufacturer, too, was probably preparing.
I would think, yeah. Yeah, they're going to be calling one of these days. Yeah.
Right.
Imagine that you're sitting in the room stitching, doing all that gold work. Imagine what's behind you in terms of supplies. Holy smokes.
Yeah.
Just, yeah. Boxes.
Well, even just as a student, you've got a wealth of materials available to you as part of your studies.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Cause the candy store.
Yeah. Cause everything we've heard about people who've taken classes there is it's blank slate, figure it out, create it. Well, the stuff's got to be available. Yeah.
Right.
Cool stuff. So, yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. That was, that worked out well. And, I want to say, that's always interesting to me. I have to say, a good thing. No, you want to say a good thing.
Not to say it.
Brenna Black, who is the PR marketing person for the Royal School, she's my primary contact. She is phenomenal. She is just one of those, and I've worked with a ton of PR people through my 45 years of magazine stuff. I mean, that's who I work with all the time, PR marketing people.
Right.
And I'd put her top five, and I've worked with some really, really good ones, but I'd put her top five easy. She is just excellent at what she does, making it happen, keeping it organized, keeping it on track. She's really superb. Royal School, hang on to her. Oh, I had one with the magazine. She was a fantastic one. Just really top flight. Really helping me do a lot of editorial content from a lot of sources. She left. It's like, oh man, just no, don't go get a new job. Just stay at this one.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the job she went to,
they're going to pay you.
Yeah. The job she went to was really cool and I couldn't blame her, but I didn't want to lose her either.
Right. Yeah.
She was just one of those, hey, I'm in a pinch. Can you get something? Sure. I got it for you. Three days later, here you go. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Those are valuable people.
Yes, they are.
Well, she's gone. So.
Darn.
Yep. All right. Now, just before we started recording, you cost me money.
You're welcome.
I mean, literally cost me money right here. So, okay, Tanya Berlin, we talked to her a long time ago, Berlin Embroidery.
Yeah.
Needle case kits. All right, how'd you come upon these things?
I get her newsletter, and periodically I just wander through her website. The thing that caught my eye was the Habsburg lace. And the other thing is I was looking for potential projects for our face-to-face chapter for next year.
Oh, okay.
And the Habsburg lace is, it's just, you know, needlepoint, simple needlepoint, but it's certain stitches that create a lacy look.
Wait, we should back up and tell people what we're talking about here.
Yes.
So okay. go ahead. You tell you know more than I do.
Okay. Well, I don't, I mean, I was just poking around her website looking for, I saw something about this needle book. And so I went and looked at it and looked at the pattern. Then I was poking around the website for some other stuff. And I found a Habsburg lace sampler. That's an advanced, intermediate to advanced. So I bought that after I bought the needle book. The thing that's nice about the needle book is that when you purchase the pattern for the needle book, you get the instructions for assembly for free. And it is a PDF for both of them. So you don't have to pay shipping from, she's in Canada.
Right. Yeah. She's in Canada. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not to mention the eternity it takes for stuff to get here.
Yeah. Although the sampler that I just talked about, she doesn't sell as a PDF. And so it didn't take all that long to get it. I was kind of surprised.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, a couple weeks.
Oh,
it wasn't bad.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, what caught my attention about this needle book is the way that it's constructed. So I think bookmaking is fascinating. And I follow two or three people on Instagram and YouTube who make books. One of them reproduces like historic books. He does other things too. He took all of his Dungeons and Dragons manuals. I think there were four of them, paperback type things. And he put them all into a leather bound book.
Oh boy.
That was really fun to watch. And then he did something with a copy of Dune that was kind of similar. So anyway, then another one just makes little books, you know, with paper and fabric and whatever. And then I just started watching one recently who does book conservation. And that's pretty interesting too.
Yeah. So
normally needle books are just sewn through the spine. You know, you take your felt and you fold it in half and put some stitches through the center of the fold. And, you know, that's it. They're pretty simple. And I don't use needle books, really. I usually just keep my needles in the little paper things that they come in. And I carry a whole set with me in my stitching bag. And, you know, I've got needles all around here. But this particular project, she uses the French link bookbinding technique. Now I have the PDF open for it, which is real similar to how they create a book, where you have the pages, in this case, they're felt. And she puts two ribbons around the back. I'm not describing it, but you can maybe put a picture in. For people that don't know how books are made, there's usually linen bands that go across the back of the book and they're not actually sewn through when the book is stitched together, but there can be interesting patterns of stitches across those linen bands. Mm-hmm. So she's kind of replicating that with ribbon. And then so the back of the book can, of the needlebook, you can see the thread going over the ribbons. And she, the way that she gives the instructions is just exactly how you would make a book. You mark where you're going to, where the holes are going to, where you're going to put your needle through each folded page. And then she tells you, you know, where you start and how you add the next one and so on. And then you just glue the covers on. So this captured my interest. And so that's why I went ahead and bought the project.
In my quick scan, she has how many designs? Two or three or four?
So in the pattern itself, there are, I think there's two full designs. Oh, let's see. I'm looking at the, there's two designs. So I think she put one on the front and one on the back.
Oh, okay.
They're pretty similar. The stitches are eyelets, double cross, which are Smyrnas. She calls them double crosses, French knots, and that's it.
Yeah.
But they're put together so that they look lacy. And she's, the models are black canvas and white thread. So it kind of enhances the lacy look to it.
Yeah. 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 They're beautiful.
Yeah. I'm going to try it.
And it looks like you can have as many pages as you want.
Yes, I think so. Now there, you might need to have a, you know, maybe a, I don't know if you need to have an even number or an odd number. That would be a consideration for the French link technique. I don't know. I haven't read through it that closely yet. You need a minimum of two pieces of felt, and there's no limit to the amount of pages of felt that the needle case can have. So you can make it as big as you want.
That's key, because that's what I have. I have one, a felt needle book, and there's not enough pages, and there's no way to add them without tearing it all apart. Well, then you might as well just make a new one.
Right.
But this one, you could easily make as many as you want and have excess pages. Because I'd like to have, like, I have enough pages right now for tapestry needles, 20 through 2 through 28 or whatever it is.
Sure.
But I'd like to have pages for embroidery needles. And, you know, and some other things.
Yeah.
To keep them all together. And so then that this book intrigues me because you can have whatever you want. So then, all right, make a list of how many different kinds of needles you want, different sizes. And, you know, count up your pages and build a book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I think if it got fairly fat, you'd probably want to put some kind of a closure on it. You know, maybe add a ribbon to tie it closed or something like that, so it's not flopping open all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But that's not hard.
That would be easy to do.
Yeah. No, it's a great idea. So, and it was not expensive. You had to buy, what is it, like $30 to buy the design, and then you get the instructions with it for free.
Right.
Yeah. That's okay. And use your stash. Yeah.
Right. You know, you'd want probably a high contrast. Just to emphasize the look of the lacy look of it.
Yeah.
No, you could do a tone on tone.
Yep.
And still get a really nice look.
Yep.
Yeah. Like you said, use your stash. And you don't need very much canvas. It's two pieces of 18 count canvas, 5 inches by 6 inches each.
That's nothing. Yeah.
No. And she says you don't even need to put that on stretcher bars. You know, you're talking about a really small piece of canvas, so you can just work it in hand.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, most people have that as scraps, yeah.
Right, and pearl cotton. You use pearl cotton for the embroidery.
So it's cheap, too. I mean, the overall cost is, other than the pattern, is negligible, yeah.
And then she used, on the model, which is black canvas. She used black felt to back the canvas embroidery.
Ah.
So, you know, the back of it's protected and it's just glued on. And then the inside, pages of the felt are glued down to the covers, just like a regular book is.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it'd be really easy to stick a couple pieces of ribbon on either side so that you could tie it closed.
Right. And see, and I start to think, all right, now once you learn that technique of how to put pages together, nothing stops you from making little sampler pages of,
oh yeah,
you know, and having a book of that.
Uh-huh.
That would be fun.
Mm-hmm.
Of any kind. Doesn't have to be on canvas, just anything. Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah, you could, you know, do a little, you know, maybe some samples of silk shading, let's mm-hmm. say,
yep.
and stitch those onto the felt pages, or just, you know, use the linen as your page.
Yeah.
You need to finish the edges somehow, but.
Well, and look, well,
you
at
could come
it,
up with.
Yeah. Look at Fibonacci squirrels. I keep wanting to call it swirls.
I know. I do too.
That got in my head and it won't leave.
I know.
But think about that now. We've talked several times about color combinations. Huh? You know, build a book where you take Karen watercolors or whatever it is,
uh-huh.
and you stitch something at the top, and then you stitch the colors that go with that as a reference. And you could build a book of that to use, you know, because you could say, here's the watercolor, and then here's a row of colors that work for this, and then here's another set. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could build a whole thing that would be a quick reference for future projects.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. There we have it.
You could do surface embroidery samples.
Yep.
You could do that right on the felt.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep. All right. There it is. Tanya Berlin. She was great. It's been a while since we talked to her. Berlin yeah. Embroidery. She's in Canada. And, yeah. Do a Cindy. Peruse the site. But then also get the needle case kit.
Yeah.
Yep. Good one. Okay. There's our expenditure for the day. Have to have one every day, you know.
At least.
All right, we're going to play. All right, this is a variation of what we've done in the past here in recent weeks. I'm calling it this or this.
Okay.
So I made a list of things where you got to make a choice.
Uh-huh.
And I think I did okay in terms of making them hard.
Yeah, you did.
I had a moment where things were coming to me. It was on a bike ride.
That oh, how do you remember it all then?
Oh, it stays with me, and I come right home and I put it all down. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, it's that after an hour, it takes an hour, and then your head clears, and then yeah, you start having the ideas. Yep.
Uh huh.
Yeah, the body gets into a rhythm. It realizes that we're going to do this, whether the body likes it or not. We're going to ride uh-huh. this bike for a long while.
Uh-huh.
So it just shuts up, and then we just go ride. Mm-hmm. Yep. Up to that point, you know, it's kind of, yeah, pretty easy to talk yourself into turning around and going home. But
uh-huh.
yeah, after that hour, off we go. See you later.
mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're just going to go down the list. Some of these will be duds. Some will be good. We'll see what happens.
Okay.
All right. So the one that started it all off, this or this, mm-hmm. a week with Mary Corbett or a week at the Royal School?
Oh, yeah, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
And I might be more inclined to a week at the Royal School just because surface embroidery is not really what I'm doing
uh-huh.
right now. Although I did get her needle, tape measure kit.
I missed that one. Okay, I got to go back and look for that. All right.
Oh, yeah. She did a whole thing on covering a tape measure.
Oh.
With embroidery. And it's very, very cool. And it's small, okay. You know, so I figure I can do a small amount of surface embroidery.
Yeah.
And she found some really nice retractable round tape measures that are like really long.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, just spent you some more money.
I missed that one. Okay.
I don't know how, if you're getting her newsletter.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Anyway, the Royal School, you know, the gold work, the canvas work. That would probably be my choice. How about you?
Yeah, tough call. Tough call. Because, see, my gut reaction is Mary Corbett.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want to see that operation and what it's become. Because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, she has built from scratch an impressive business. Very impressive. And a body of knowledge that is hard to match.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think, all right, all the history at the Royal School. And then, you know, you're there for a week. So then the museums you could go to, Hand and Lock, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the location is a whole other story. You know, if you're talking, if you're including that, then definitely I'd say the Royal School.
Yeah.
You know, some town in Kansas.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's not going to be a lot of other interesting stuff there.
Yeah. Okay. So, but if we take them and put them in, you know, in the middle of North Dakota, and you got to choose one.
I'd still choose the Royal School because of their techniques.
Yeah. That's probably where I'd end up. Yeah. All the knowledge, all the history, because even just their collection, to see their collection.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. All right. Yep. Sorry, Mary. I don't think she listens. All right. Off of that, touring textile museums in Europe or going to Winterthur and other East Coast museums in the U.S.?
I don't know. That's a tough one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because Winterthur alone would be worth the trip.
Yeah. And I'm sure that there are a lot of other, I mean, I know there are a lot of other textile or museums that have textiles. I don't know what kind of needlework exhibits the other museums in the East Coast have.
Yeah. Well, the first thing I'd do is call Barbara Hudson.
Oh, there you go.
I mean, that'd be first step. Barbara, where do I go and can you get me in, you know? Because there's a ton of textile art, particularly in the East,
mm-hmm.
that is old and has a lot of story behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there's several organizations, particularly where near Barbara and near the Baltimore area, organizations that research that stuff. I mean, there've been all kinds of books come out of people in these organizations. I mean, there's a lot of knowledge and history.
Well, and then it's not really East Coast, but the Embroiderers Guild.
Yep.
Has a fantastic exhibit.
Yeah. Yeah. We could stop there on the way.
Huh?
Yep. Just go through Kentucky and right on over to, yeah.
Yeah.
But then I look at art museums, needle textile art museums in Europe, and I think, all right, now you get to see stuff from the 16 and 1700s.
Much older, yeah.
Yeah. So what does that do other than blow your mind?
Yeah.
Because, we think we're all hot and got it all figured out, in 2024 when it comes to needle art. And I think if you go back to the 1600s and 1700s, I think you get humbled in a hurry.
Oh, yeah.
Like we can't even get in the room with what they did. Yeah, I think so. I mean, well, we've seen pieces. I mean, they're just amazing. And it's like, well, how'd they do that? Yeah.
Right,
It's
right.
2024. We have all the technology. How'd they do that? Yeah, well, it's still needle and thread. Doesn't matter.
Well, I mean, we don't have the materials that they used to have.
Yep.
And it's just like, I mean, we see this today that things disappear, threads and other materials disappear because nobody's using them.
Yeah.
So, when, especially ecclesiastical stuff, when that in England, when the Catholics were ousted, then a lot of that ecclesiastical work was disappeared and wasn't continued, I don't think, as much.
Yeah.
A lot of the gold work was used for royal and military kinds of ornamentation. But
Yeah.
there's other things. There's the samplers, the caskets, the tapestries, bed hangings, linens
Yeah.
that aren't as flashy, but still the history is there,
Right.
and that they are still with us is amazing.
Yeah. Not turned to dust. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No, it's yeah, I think I'd probably end up in Europe. But I'd go through the East Coast first on my way, Cheat the game. Cheat the game. 'Cause you look at the history, but then those guilds where there was competition between the guilds to outdo each other.
Right.
That hat, it wasn't a hat that Mike Parr and those guys recreated. I mean, it's astounding
Yeah.
work. I forget what
Yeah.
that's called. Yeah, but that came out of those guilds just
Was
trying
it
to
a
outdo.
crown?
Was it a
Did they
crown?
call it a crown?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
For the broderers?
yeah, the Broiderers Guild. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. And it's just, it's just a bunch of guys trying to one up each other. It is. And then the women came along and said, well, actually, we're better at it. Yeah. But yeah, I think I'd end up there because that really ancient stuff fascinates me, especially medieval stuff.
Yes.
The lifestyles those people and the conditions they lived in, and then to come up with stuff. But yeah, and when the Catholics were ousted, I mean, just think through history, all of the textile art, no matter what church, what denomination, what faith, all that's been destroyed. Just imagine. Holy smokes. Just,
And it and is being destroyed
Yes.
in lots of different places.
Yep.
But don't forget arts and crafts. There was a lot of beautiful needlework done during the arts and crafts movement. I was reading about William Morris's sister. And you know who William Morris was,
Right.
right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. His sister was a renowned embroiderer.
Yeah, she was quite famous. Yeah.
And of course, I can't remember her name, but
Betty, I
there
believe. Wasn't it Betty? No.
I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know. But yeah, I mean, lots of stuff, lots of different eras and types of work to look at and marvel over.
Yeah. Yep. And with people, highly talented people, and then think about they were, they didn't have magnifiers and LED lights, and in a lot of ways were using whatever they could put their hands on. except for the wealthy. But
right,
you know, it just I think that's right. Where I'd end up, Europe.
Yeah,
I think so. Go for the history, mm-hmm. really old history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, then miss my flight on the way back and meet up with Barbara and.
Yeah.
Oh darn! It'll be another week. I couldn't get on another plane. Sorry. All right, gold work or black work?
I'm probably going to say black work. I like both of them. Black work's a little more approachable, I think. You don't need as much. All you need is some linen and some thread.
Yeah.
And patterns.
Yeah.
Gold work, you know, is a lot more expensive.
Yeah.
But it's so beautiful, and I I have not started my frog or my koi fish from the classes that we took with
Clara.
Clara.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I've been working on other stuff. So.
Yeah. See, this
but
is.
But I will get to those.
This is tough because I think if I had to choose, like gun to my head, gold work. Because. But you see, I think these two, you can't say one's more challenging than the other.
Oh, no.
Because no. I think black work, the way good black work is done has to be, and I've never done it. I bought the books, but I've never actually sat down and done it. But the people who do it well, it is stunning stuff.
Mm-hmm. And I haven't tried to do any of that kind of almost portraiture kind of black work, you know, with a lot of shading and all that. I've just done geometric filling stitches in different shapes.
Yeah.
So nothing really, really, really out of the ordinary when it comes right down to it. You know, they're really nice, really cool pieces, but it is just a shape filled with geometric filling stitches.
Yeah, yeah.
Now when you get to the point to where you're shading in a face of an animal or something like that, you know, that's a whole other level.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what impresses me is when, all right, we're using three or four thicknesses of thread and you're shading. And if you stand back, it's a black and white portrait. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's astounding to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then you take gold work, even that simple little frog or koi that Clara did, it's pretty impressive.
Oh, yeah.
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 Yep.
And to plug Tanya again, she does both techniques.
Yeah.
So more to look at on her website.
Buy from Tanya. Yep.
Yeah.
All right. A day with your favorite designer or a week-long stitching vacation?
Oh, I'd do a week-long stitching vacation.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I'd do the designer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why?
Because I'd like to be a fly on the wall. You know, take Nicola Jarvis.
Uh-huh.
Because we talked to her recently in her book of animals and flora and fauna from her walks with her dog.
Right.
To spend a day and see a design come together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, see the mistakes, see the rejections, see what works. To watch the mind work
mm-hmm.
would, I think I would, that would be a day for me.
Yeah, see, I don't think you'd see that much in a day.
No?
No. I mean, you'd see a certain amount, but, you know, it took her months, maybe years to develop everything that's in that book. There's a lot in the book.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you consider any one particular design, you know, the amount of time it took her to think of it and then decide what the shape was going to be and what elements she was going to put in it and then do the testing. I mean, I just think a day isn't enough.
Yeah, probably not.
Which is why I chose the week-long stitching vacation.
I'd still like to watch the mind work. All right, so where would this vacation be? What, describe this vacation.
Well, I don't really care.
Oh.
Do
you do a cruise? Do you go to a cabin in the woods?
No. Actually, I'm going to go to the ANG seminar. That counts as a week-long stitching vacation, I think.
There we go. Okay, yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, probably a seminar.
Okay.
Which, I mean, that's not the same as spending time with a designer as they're developing their designs, but you know, you get to have the teacher there.
Okay.
And so the class I'm taking is a 4-day class.
Okay. But so the vacation for you is to be with other stitchers then?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, a retreat or, you know, there is a place in Wisconsin called Woodland Ridge, and they do quilting retreats. It looks like it's a beautiful part of the state, kind of a wooded area. And I don't know how I got on their mailing list, but they, because I don't quilt. But I look at the classes that they have, and they have some amazing classes. And it is like, you know, you go for a week and you just, I suppose you take your sewing machine. I doubt that they provide the sewing machines, but they might. But you just, you know, build quilts for a week.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's probably that. Although I'd be perfectly happy just to go someplace and sit and stitch. And that probably would be a cabin in the woods or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
See, or maybe a high end hotel with a spa and a pool and great restaurants.
The suite.
Yeah. Suite. Yeah.
Yeah. Breakfast brought in the morning. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Hampering. Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's, yeah, okay, there it is. Yeah, the hotel suite where people go on a trip and get upgraded to a suite, but you're only in it to sleep, so what's the big deal?
Right.
So you spend a week and you actually use the suite.
Mm-hmm.
With a view, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, I'd be cabin in the woods, my bike and needlework.
Uh-huh.
Yep. Get up in the morning, go for a ride, come back, shower, stitch.
So when I was a lot younger, I was a belly dancer.
Really?
Yeah. And I went to a dance camp one year in the Mendocino Woodlands in California, Northern California, in the middle of the Redwood Forest.
Ooh.
It was fantastic.
Ooh.
They had, you know, a couple of large buildings where we had the classes and, you know, where you ate and stuff like that. But then we stayed in cabins, and there, I think there were like maybe 4 people per cabin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you just walk back and forth to wherever your class is going to be. And we saw deer and the redwoods are much different than our not the trees, the woodlands are much different than our woods. There's not a lot of understory because the redwoods shade everything out, you know? So it's like, you're just walking through this wooded area and there's needles on the floor of the forest and, you know, maybe a few little plants on the forest floor, but mostly it's just not much. No. It was beautiful.
Yeah.
It was really a lot of fun.
Yeah. If people haven't been, go to San Francisco, go across the Golden Gate Bridge and check them out. Yeah, it's a weird thing, isn't it? It's a weird environment.
Yeah.
Because the canopy is so high.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. Yeah, there's nothing underneath. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Okay, now I got to know about belly dancing. That looks like, to me, a lot of training. it looks like always has struck me like there's more to it than it appears, I guess.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of it does take a lot of practice to be able to do some of the dance steps.
Yeah.
And some of the other things I've done dances where I worked with a sword and had the sword on my head.
Oh, really?
Or a vase. I had a brass pitcher. It was actually a pitcher that I would dance with on my head.
Balance
and
it?
It had water in it. Yeah, balance it.
With water in it?
With water in it. And then I'd pour the water out, you know, so it would, people would know that there was actually something in it.
Oh.
Yeah. I did it for a long, long time.
Wow. Because water starts sloshing around, you're in trouble, huh?
Well, but all the movement is in your hips.
Yeah, but still.
Yeah. But yeah, that takes a lot of practice to be able to do that and, oh. and keep your head, you know, it's like walking around as a kid, a long time ago, you know, put a book on your head and have to walk with the book on your head. That's that kind of thing.
Yeah. But water starts moving.
Well, it wasn't a lot of water.
And I know,
it was,
but yeah.
You know.
Wow. That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course I made all my own costumes.
Oh.
So totally beaded and sequined bras and belts.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Cool.
That was the only way I got to wear chiffon and beads and stuff like that because I had no other reason to do it.
But it's cool because I mean that's an ancient art form. You know, that's, yeah. Yeah, that stuff's cool. I don't know. I love that old stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, folks, thanks for watching Dancing with the Stars. And now back to, all right, watching linen get made and dyed or watching specialty threads get made?
So the linen is a much longer process. You know, if you start with the plant.
Right.
Okay, so here I'm going to digress again. I think we've talked about this before. One of the YouTubers I follow is the art restoration guy in Chicago, Baumgartner.
Mm-hmm.
He did a series of videos recently that he called them Behind the Canvas, I think it was, where he went to paint manufacturers and, you know, all different kinds of people that are behind what he usually sees. One of the places that he went was to Belgium, and he started with the linen, with the flax growers,
uh-huh.
and talked to the farmers that grow the flax and talk to them about, you know, how it's treated. And I knew that before because I've seen other things about it, but it was just something that I ran into recently. And then, you know, so there's the whole growing it, preparing it, spinning it, weaving it.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot more there than there is for specialty threads, I think.
Yeah. See, for me, it's the linen for just that very reason. But I don't want to watch. I want to do.
Oh.
You know, I want somebody knows what they're doing, and I go with them, and we cut the flax and beat it and do whatever they do to it. Because I've watched, I've done it. Well, I watched the guy that you told me about, the restoration guy. But there have been other videos about how it gets made. I want to do that.
Right.
Yeah, just to experience it.
Yeah.
Because how you get just those reeds of essentially grass to become fabric is amazing to me.
Well, not only that, but soft fabric.
Right, right.
Because, you know, when they take those stems and break them apart, it just And I know, you know, you're only taking out the fibers on the inside of the stem, but they still don't look like they can possibly be something that's going to be soft and
No.
pliable and not itchy to work with.
Right, right. Yeah, and then we buy linen at the store. It's like, no way this came from grass. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
See, I want to do that. I want to be able to walk out the door with thread and give it to Jennifer and say, here, weave this, will you?
Well, first she has to spin it.
Well, all right, we'll give it to her for that too. Here, yeah, she'll do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know that I do listen to the Long Thread Media podcast, which is, it's not Threads Magazine. It's Piecework and Handwoven. And they have, several, and they talk to lots of different people that are working with all different kinds of fibers. So they've talked to, you know, people who spin cotton and grow cotton, spin cotton, weave cotton, you know, and wool and whatever. I don't think they've talked to anybody since I've been listening to it that does linen.
Yeah.
But, you know, they talk about, they were talking to somebody that had sheep, I don't know, a while ago, and she was talking about what it's like to wrangle a sheep to shear it.
Yeah.
And the training that she had to go through to be able to do that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not easy.
You don't just show up and shear a sheep, huh? No. Poor sheep all cut up.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, see, that it amazes me. Like last week when Jennifer was showing some of the stuff she'd spun. You know, she starts with just this massive ball of dyed
fluff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the next thing you know, she's got these spindles of beautiful thread, yarn, whatever.
Yeah.
That's amazing to me.
Yeah.
You know, and then if you go and watch on YouTube any weaver and see how then they'll take that and just ramming that thing up and down and putting the shuttle through and then they have cloth. It's.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah, it really is. It's I've even thought it would be fun if I had a place to do it, to try growing some flax.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just to experience that part of it. I don't, you know, and I don't know, just to see what flax is like growing and then cutting it and then, yeah, trying to go through the process because it's rather involved.
Oh, yeah. So kind of along the same lines of taking plant material and turning it into fabric, I ran across something on, I don't know, social media, I forget which one, about a project called the Nettle Dress. So this guy spent several years, I think, figuring out how to make fabric from nettles. So,
wait, like the weeds?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, same kind of thing. You've got to break the stems down to get the fibers and get enough of them so that you can spin it. And there's actually a movie. I don't know if it's available to us in the U.S. yet. This guy's in the U.K. But if you Google the nettle dress, you'll find information about it.
Okay.
But yeah, same kind of thing, you know, start to finish of, you know, getting the fiber from living plant material or I guess dead plant material. And then in the end, creating a garment with it.
Yeah. That you can stand to wear without scratching yourself all the time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, see, that's the thing with linen or any of that stuff is, like, if you take cotton, okay, I can see how you would take cotton fibers, spin them into threads, and weave cloth. Mm-hmm. But, go back in history, who figured out how to take flax, you know, and how many different plants were tried.
Right.
And then figured out how to get the fibers out of them that you could actually make into cloth.
Mm-hmm. I mean, well, especially since it's not just as simple as pulling the stem apart. Right. They actually, I mean, in the Baumgartner video, they talked about retting the flax in the fields, just letting it get wet and rot. But they used to put it into ponds to let it, you know, get wet and rot for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently they didn't smell great. And, you know, so it's, you know, another one of those things that we don't think about what goes into creating whatever kinds of things we use, you know, yeah, whether it's textiles or, you know, whatever.
Right. But it what impresses me is, okay, take yourself back in time. They don't have the science, the mm-hmm. understanding of cellular structure and plant structure and, you know, and there's no chemistry, there's no, and then you figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just so impressive to me that somehow yeah. somebody figured out if I do this and do this, then I can get these soft fibers that I can do something with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Almost some days I think more impressive than what we do today, just, you know, given what they had to work with.
Well, right.
Yeah.
It, like you say, it, you know, who figured it out?
Right.
And then how did the technology get spread?
Yeah. 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 Who had the monopoly for how long?
Uh-huh.
You know, and then somebody says, well, wait a minute, I can do it better. I can do this. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'd love to see that. Yeah. Who was the guy? Who was the guy? And who was the guy?
Or like, woman.
Like, yeah. Yeah. Who was the person who created the wheel? And then were they making wheels for a long time before, you know, they had to hire somebody, you know? How did that work?
I can answer that.
Oh yeah?
It was, the wheel was used for pottery first.
Okay. That makes sense.
So the reason I can answer that is because the book I'm reading right now is called Nuts and Bolts.
Oh.
It's by, the woman's name is Roma Agrawal, I think. She's an engineer. And it is 7 simple inventions that changed our world, basically. And so she kind of goes through the history of each of them. So the nail, the chapter I just finished was on springs. The wheel was one of the early chapters that I read. And you know, so she talks about, you know, who came up with this first? Well, they think it was for potting, for making pots.
Huh.
And then, you know, somebody thought, well, what if we put it on its side and, you know, put an axle on it? And yeah. It's a good book. Really interesting.
Nuts and Bolts. Okay. Uh-huh. Roma Ag something.
It's Agrawal.
All right. I got to read this.
Yeah. I think you'd enjoy it.
Yeah. Because I love that stuff.
I do too.
I mean, I think that's what these old sewing machines I'm working on.
Oh, yeah.
It just the engineering that's in them, mm-hmm. not, you know, not a single piece of plastic. It's all metal on metal. There are no ball bearings.
Uh-huh.
It's all metal sliding on metal, shiny, polished surfaces when need be. And just all it's, you know, a lot of it kind of a Rube Goldberg thing. But brilliantly engineered, just brilliantly engineered, and can go for, well, I mean, I have a couple that are 100 plus years old, and, you know, you could sew with them all day long, and just as good and infinitely more durable than today's machines.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and, but, you know, that's, to me, that's just amazing. I love that stuff. Mm-hmm. And seeing how those, you know, when you tear them apart, and then I got to put them back together, and you see what those people, how they figured it out, mm-hmm. and you know how do you get this? Because you know there's on the bottom is usually at least 2 rods, and 1 rod just moves the what are called the feed dogs, the little teeth that move the cloth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so they have to keep that moving in kind of a circular fashion,
yeah.
just a little bit to keep the cloth moving, but that's got to be in sync with the needle. Mm-hmm. And you know, somebody had to figure that all out of just steel.
Yeah.
No CAD drawings, you know.
Yep.
You know, how it all has to be, you have to make parts out of steel.
Yeah.
You know? And that didn't work.
Well, and, you know, and the bodies are cast probably, right?
Oh, yeah. And heavy. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so that's a whole. So here's another fun thing I've done. I got to take a foundry class. And at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa. And we actually got to use the machines that make the sand molds.
Oh.
We weren't using iron. We used an electric arc furnace to melt aluminum and then poured the shapes that we, you know, created with the molds.
Yeah.
So somewhere around here, I have an elephant with a broken tusk. I mean, it's cracked because I dropped it when I was trying to grind it smooth. But you have to, you know, when you're casting something, you have to create a mold out of sand.
Right.
You know, it has to be the exact shape and tolerances that you need it to be. I mean, that you know, you can do some machining on it afterwards, but it has to be pretty close to right when you're casting it.
Yeah, because you're machining, that's profit going down mm-hmm. the drain. That's time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's the thing with these sewing machines. I mean, they're like, I don't know, 40 pounds. I mean, they're heavy. Cast iron, steel, whatever. But then they have to be cast such that you can run steel rods through and do this precise sewing.
Right.
You know, the holes all have to be there. You have to cut holes to put oil in. You got to mm-hmm. cut holes to service them. Yeah, yep. Same kind of, it has to be precise. There's no monkeying around with this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't realize molded pieces of any kind, the real expense is that mold. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's huge. And, well, how about if you make it like this? Yeah, you know, you pay for the mold, and we'll make 100 of them for you. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, because the mold is... it's what is pressed into the sand to create the cavity
mm-hmm.
that the metal is going to be poured into.
Yeah.
And it's got a top and a bottom.
Right.
And, you know, so you create two. So the bottom is the vessel is filled with sand and tamped down, and then you press the mold into it, and then another kind of outer shell comes down, and you fill that part that creates the other side of the machine, and it's all tamped down really, really hard so that it won't fall apart.
Yeah.
Once the metal goes in.
Okay, question on that. When you're done casting a piece, does the sand get reused?
Some of it's reused. There's a lot of other stuff in the sand. It's not just plain old ordinary sand,
right,
especially
right.
These days. Probably was to start with. But, you know, it has to be a certain moisture level to stick together.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other things in the mixture to, you know, probably help with the finish and, you know, who knows what.
Yeah.
But yeah, some of it can be reused.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that had to have been a fascinating class.
It was.
Yeah.
But what was more fun was actually going into foundries, which I did several as a consultant for health and safety. That was, I love going into foundries, especially in an old kind of a dirt foundry, you know, where they're actually making the molds out of sand, you know, kind of not so much assembly line, but, you know, almost not totally a one-off, but, you know, maybe they're making 50 or 100 of something rather than,
yeah.
You know, I've been in the big foundries too, but the small foundries I think are more fun. The funny thing is that, you know, once once the metal is poured in, the sand, the molds are just there. Well, they're put on, they're put down on the floor of the foundry to be filled. And at that point, they don't have anything around them. It's just the sand. And there's all kinds of, can be kind of explosive noises. It's someplace where you don't really want to be a nervous type person, or you're constantly jumping because of the hot metal going into the cold, more or less cold sand.
Uh-huh.
And then when they're set, you know, they just kind of kick them over and knock the sand off of them. And then they have to be cleaned because a lot of the, you know, sand will stick to the metal.
Yeah.
But the excess sand, you know, they collect and they can reuse, they can, you know, recondition it, reuse it.
Yeah. Wow. I'm just now imagining all the safety factors. Holy smokes.
Oh yeah.
Oof.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the Industrial Revolution when they didn't care. Ooh.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Dangerous places. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very much so.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. I just looked at the clock. Oops.
Oh, yeah. Oops.
Oops. All right. We got to quit right there. The list is long. Yeah. We got 5 of them.
Oh, okay. Well, you can pick it up with Beth or whoever you talk, or yep. Jennifer.
Yep. Good one. Okay. All right. That's it. So once again, no show this Sunday. Next Wednesday, if we can work it out with Kim, we'll get to see some of the work her mother did. And then a week from Sunday will be the Royal School coronation video. I'm going to pull the audio track off and make a podcast out of it. But you'll want to watch the video. And I'll put the video on the Fiber Talk website page, too, so that it'll all be contained. But, yeah, you don't want to miss that. All right, that's it. Thanks for listening.
Bye.